Part 7, The Siren Song of Hollywood.
When I was in seventh grade, The Twilight Zone was my favorite television show. I never dreamed that one day I'd be writing for it. Now, let us make it clear that we're talking about two different shows here. I must look one hell of a lot older than I think, because sometimes when I mention that I worked on The Twilight Zone, I get the response, "Oh, I loved that show. What was it like to work with Rod Serling?" The clueless inevitably drop a T into Rod Serling's name. I loved that show, too, but sad to say I never worked with Rod Serling or even Rod Serling. I did, however, work with Phil DeGuerre, Jim Crocker, Alan Brennert, Rockne S. O'Bannon, and Michael Cassett, as well as a host of terrific actors and directors on the short-lived and much-lamented Twilight Zone revival of 1985-87. Call it TZ2. There have been two more incarnations since, TZ3 and TZ4, but we prefer not to talk about them in polite company. It was the Armageddon rag that sent me off to the Twilight Zone. Published by Poseidon Press in 1983, the rag was supposed to be the breakout novel that would transform me into a best-selling author. I was proud of the book, and my agent and my editor were high on it as well. Poseidon paid me a whopping big advance for the rights, and I went right out and bought a larger house. The Rag received some wonderful reviews. It was nominated for the World Fantasy Award, losing out to John M. Ford's superb The Dragon Waiting, and it died to death. It had all the hallmarks of a big bestseller, save one. No one bought it. Far from building on the success of Fever Dream, it sold badly in hardcover and miserably in paperback. The full extent of the disaster was not brought home to me until 1985, when Kirby tried to sell my unfinished fifth novel, Black and White and Red All Over, and found that neither Poseidon nor any other publisher was willing to make me an offer. Yet even as the Armageddon rag slammed one door shut behind me, it was opening another. Dismal though its sales had been, the rag did have its ardent fans. One was Phil DeGuerre, the creator and executive producer of the hit television series Simon & Simon. DeGuerre was a huge fan of rock music, especially the Grateful Dead. When our mutual agent, Marvin Moss, showed him my book, Phil saw a feature film in it and optioned the movie rights. He intended to write and direct the film himself and to shoot the huge concert sequences at Grateful Dead shows. I'd sold other film options previously. My usual involvement was limited to signing the contract and cashing the check. Phil DeGuerre was different. The ink was hardly dry on the deal before he flew me out to L.A. and put me up at a hotel for several days so we could talk about the book and how best to adapt it. Phil went on to write several drafts of the screenplay but was never able to get a studio to bite for the financing. No movie was made. During the course of this, however, he and I got to know each other a little bit. Enough so that when he decided to revive The Twilight Zone for CBS in 1985, Phil phoned me to ask if I would like to try a script. Surprisingly, I did not immediately leap at the chance. I had been weaned on television, sure, but I'd never written for it, had never wanted to write for it, knew nothing about script writing, had never even seen a screenplay or a teleplay. Besides, all you ever heard about writing for Hollywood was the horror stories. I'd read Harlan Ellison's Glass Teat, after all. I'd even read the other Glass Teat. I knew how crazy it was out there. On the other hand, I liked Phil and respected him, and he had Alan Brennert on his staff, another writer whose work I had admired. DeGuerre had brought Harlan Ellison aboard as well as a writer and consultant. Maybe this new Twilight Zone would be different. And if truth be told, I needed the money. At the time, I was madly writing Haviland Tough stories to fill out Tough Voyaging and keep my mortgage paid. But Black and White and Red All Over still had not sold, and my career as a novelist lay in ruins. I was still hesitating when Phil cinched a deal by promising my lady Paris backstage passes to all the Grateful Dead shows we cared to see. You couldn't say no to that. He mailed me the show's Bible and a stack of sample scripts, and I sent him a stack of tear sheets and Xerox copies of stories I thought would make good Twilight Zone episodes. Since I had never done a teleplay before, I wanted to make things easier for myself by doing an adaptation rather than an original story. That way I could concentrate on mastering the form rather than having to come up with the plot and characters and dialogue as well. Adaptations did not pay as well as originals, but I was more concerned with not making an utter fool of myself than I was with making money. Daguerre liked a number of the stories I sent him, and half a dozen would end up becoming episodes of TZ2. Some adapted by me, some by other hands. For my first outing, however, the tale that was chosen was Knackles, a Christmas horror fable by a writer named Kurt Clark. I'd found it in an obscure Terry Carr anthology. Knackles was the sort of idea that makes you slap your head and cry, "Why didn't I think of that?" Every god must have his devil. Knackles was the anti-Santa. On Christmas Eve, while Santa Claus is flying around the world in his sled, sliding down chimneys to leave presents for good boys and girls, Knackles is moving through pitch-dark tunnels beneath the earth in a railroad car pulled by a team of blind white goats and crawling up through the furnace grate to stuff bad boys and girls in his big black sack. I was delighted by Phil's choice. Knackles seemed to me to be a perfect Twilight Zone, given a faithful adaptation. I also took a little pleasure in imagining the thrill the sale would give Kurt Clark, this obscure, forgotten little writer who I pictured teaching English composition at some community college in nowhere in North Dakota or godforsaken Georgia. It turned out that Kurt Clark was a pseudonym for Donald E. Westlake, the best-selling author of the wonderful Dortmunder series and 100 other mysteries and crime novels, half of which had been turned into feature films. It also turned out, once rights had been secured and I had signed my contract, that the guys at Twilight Zone did not want a faithful adaptation of Westlake's story. They liked the notion of the anti-Santa, but not the rest of it, the abusive former football star who invents Knackles to terrorize his children, his wife and kids, the brother-in-law who narrates the story. All of that had to go, I was told. Before I could start my script, I would need to come up with a whole new story for Knackles and present it in a treatment. So much for adaptations being easier. I came up with half a dozen ways to tackle Knackles. The first one or two I wrote up as formal treatments. The later ones I pitched to Harlan over the phone. He didn't like any of them. After a month of this, I hit a wall. I had no more fresh ideas for Knackles and remained convinced that the best way to handle material was the way Westlake handled it in his story. Harlan was growing as frustrated as I was, and I got the impression that Phil Daguerre was ready to pull the plug. At that point, Harlan came up with an idea. Another episode had also been giving trouble, an original called The Once and Future King, about an Elvis impersonator who travels back in time and finds himself face to face with Elvis. A freelancer named Bryce Maritano had done several drafts of the script, but Daguerre and his team still felt it needed work. I was no stranger to rock and roll, as the Armageddon rag bore witness. Harlan suggested a switch. He would take over Knackles himself, and I would move to the Maritano script. Phil thought it was worth a try, and the swap was made, with fateful consequences for all concerned. The subsequent tale of Knackles is as horrifying as Knackles himself. Harlan Ellison's approach to the story met with more approval than mine had, and his script was duly written and given the green light. Ed Asner was cast in the lead role, and Harlan himself was set to direct. He had added a new twist to the Westlake story, however, one that drew the ire of the network censors. In the midst of pre-production, Knackles was brought to a screeching halt by standards and practices. For those who are curious, all the grisly details of what followed can be found in Harlan's collection Slippage, Houghton Mifflin, 1998, along with Westlake's original story and Harlan's teleplay. Despite good faith efforts by Phil and Harlan to address the network's concerns, the CBS censors proved unrelenting. Knackles was scrapped, and Harlan left the show. Meanwhile, I was still at home in Santa Fe, 1,000 miles away from the storms, reading up about the King. Elvis had shouldered Knackles aside. I wrote my treatment of the Once and Future King, and when that was approved, I launched into the script. It was the first teleplay I had ever attempted, so it took me longer than it should have. I shot it off to the Twilight Zone with considerable trepidation. If Phil did not like what I'd done, I figured my first teleplay would also be my last. He did like it. Not well enough to shoot my first draft, mind you. I soon learned that in Hollywood no one ever likes a script that much. But well enough to offer me a staff job after Knackles blew up and Harlan's departure left the Zone shorthanded. Suddenly I was off to a land of both shadow and substance of things and ideas, somewhere between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. Studio City, California. I joined the series near the end of its first season as a lowly staff writer. You know the position is lowly if the title includes the word writer. My first contract was for 6 weeks, and even that seemed optimistic. After a strong start, the ratings for TZ2 had slumped off steadily, and no one knew whether CBS would renew the series for a second season. I began my stint by doing several more drafts of The Once and Future King, then moved on to new scripts, adaptations of Roger Zelazny's The Last Defender of Camelot and Phyllis Eisenstein's Lost and Found. 6 weeks of talking story with Daguerre, Crocker, Brennert, and O'Bannon, reading scripts, giving and taking notes, sitting in on pitch meetings, and watching the show being filmed taught me more than I could have learned in 6 years back in Santa Fe. None of my own scripts went before the cameras until the very end, when The Last Defender of Camelot was finally sent into production. Casting, budgets, pre-production meetings, working with a director, all of it was new to me. My script was too long and too expensive. That would prove to be a hallmark of my career in film and television. All my scripts would be too long and too expensive. I tried to keep Roger Zelazny informed of all the changes we had to make so he would not be too taken aback when he saw his story on the air. At one point, our line producer, Harvey Fran, came to me with a worried look on his face. "You can have horses," he told me, "or you can have Stonehenge, but you can't have horses and Stonehenge." That was a hard call, so I put the question to Roger. "Stonehenge," he said at once, and Stonehenge it was. They built it on the soundstage behind my office, with wood and plaster and painted canvas. If there had been horses on the stage, Stonehenge would have trembled like a leaf every time one pounded by, but without horses, the fake rocks worked fine. Not so the stunt work, alas. The director wanted to see Sir Lancelot's face during the climactic sword fight, which entailed removing the visor from Richard Kiley's helm, and that of his stunt double as well. All went well until someone zigged instead of zagging during the sword play, and the stuntman's nose was cut off. "Not the whole nose," Harvey Frand explained to me, "just the end bit." The Last Defender of Camelot was broadcast on April 11, 1986, as part of TZ2's first season closer. After we wrapped, I went home to Santa Fe, not knowing if there would be a second season. For all I knew, my brief stint in television was done. But when the networks announced their fall schedules in May, it turned out that CBS had renewed The Twilight Zone after all. I was promoted from staff writer to story editor and headed back to Studio City. Several new writers and producers joined us for that abbreviated second season, most notably Michael Cassett, who took my place at the bottom of the food chain as the lowly staff writer. Cassett had the office next to mine. Short, cynical, talented, funny, and wise in all the ways of Hollyweird, he showed me how to get a better office, come to work early and move in, and joined me in trying to teach Phil Daguerre's cockatoo to say, "Stupid idea," which we thought would enliven pitch meetings no end. The second season of TZ2 got off to a great start for me. Both of my leftover season one scripts, Lost and Found and The Once and Future King, were put into production. The latter became our second season opener. As story editor, I did more duties, more rewrites, and had a bigger role in pitch meetings. I wrote two new teleplays as well. The Toys of Caliban was another adaptation, this time of a story by Terry Matz. The Road Less Traveled was my first and last original for The Zone. The idea was one I'd come up with a few years earlier for an anthology about the war in Vietnam, but had never gotten around to writing. On an anthology show like The Twilight Zone, the stories are the stars. We had no leads with fat weekly salaries, no recurring characters to service, no continuing storylines. As a result, we could sometimes attract feature actors and directors who would never have consented to appear on an ordinary episodic drama. I got very lucky with The Road Less Traveled. My script was sent to Wes Craven. He liked it and agreed to direct. We speak of television programs running an hour, most dramas, or a half hour, all sitcoms. But of course, the shows themselves are nowhere near that long, since commercials eat up a large amount of that time. In the mid-80s, an hour-long drama was roughly 46 minutes long, a half-hour sitcom, about 23 minutes. Of course, when you shoot a script, It's very rare that you will get exactly as much film as you need. Most rough cuts run long, by anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes. No problem. The show's editors, working with the director and the producers, simply take the tape into the editing room and trim until they have 46 or 23 minutes of footage, as required. Rod Serling's original Twilight Zone was a half-hour program for most of its run. It is those episodes that most fans recall. The show actually expanded to a full hour for one season, but those hours are seldom seen in syndication since they will not fit into the same time slots as the rest of the series' run. Whether an hour or a half hour, however, Serling's Twilight Zone featured only one story per episode. TZ2 was an hour-long show, but it used the format of another Serling series, The Night Gallery, rather than that of the original Zone. Each hour was made up of two or three unconnected tales of varying length. It was seldom as neat as dividing one 46-minute hour into two 23-minute half hours. One week, the show might have a 30-minute episode teamed with one that ran 16 minutes. The next week, a 21-minute segment with a 25. The week after, an 18, a 15, and a 13. It did not matter how long the individual segments ran, so long as they added up to 46 minutes after editing. The road less traveled was too long and too expensive, but it was felt to be a strong script, and it had a very strong director in Wes Craven, who shot some terrific film. When Wes turned in his director's cut, it was longer than all but a few of our previous segments, but it was also a powerful little film. The decision was made to make only minor trims to Wes Craven's cut. If the hour ran long, time could always be taken out of the other segment to get us down to the necessary 46 minutes. The show, as finally assembled, paired a 36-minute cut of The Road Less Traveled with a 10-minute version of, well, to tell the truth, I no longer recall which second season episode I had drawn as my running mate. The show was edited, color timed, scored. Effects were added, along with the opening and closing narrations. Around the office, Mike Cassett and my other friends were congratulating me. There was talk of Emmy Awards for Wes Craven and Cliff DeYoung. The show was delivered to the network, locked and finished, and ready for broadcast. Then CBS took The Twilight Zone off the air. It should not have come as a shock. Our ratings had been weak at the end of the first season, and had only gotten weaker during the second. Even so, the network was not canceling the show. Not quite. Instead, they were taking us off the air for retooling. Gloom descended on the MTM lot as we sat around our offices waiting for the other shoe to drop. Soon enough it did. We were going back on the air in a new time slot as a half-hour show. The original Twilight Zone had enjoyed its greatest success as a half-hour, CBS reasoned. Perhaps we could do the same. And by the way, no more of this two or three stories per show stuff. From now on, each episode would be a single story, 23 minutes in length. As for those episodes already in the can, they would have to be re-edited to fit the new half-hour format. The Road Less Traveled was broadcast on December 18, 1986, but it was not the show that I had been so proud of. A truncated, mutilated remnant aired instead. 13 minutes had been excised, more than a third of the episode's original length. The pacing was shot to hell, and much of the character development was gone. If any of you chanced to catch The Road Less Traveled in syndication, it was the butchered version you saw. The original 36-minute cut was never aired, and so far as I know, only two copies of it still exist on tape. Wes Craven has one, I understand. I have the other. I would show it to you if I could, but I can't. For what it's worth, I can't really quarrel with the network's decision. The Twilight Zone was dying. CBS had to try something. The half-hour format was worth a shot. In hindsight, the series might have been better off if it had been a half-hour show right from the start. So I cannot fault the suits for making the change. I only wished I had waited a week until after The Road Less Traveled had been aired. Sad to say, ratings showed no notable improvement, and CBS finally pulled the plug halfway through the second season. A short time later, a third incarnation of The Twilight Zone arose from our ashes and produced 30 cheap new half-hour shows, which were bundled with our episodes to make a syndication package. TZ3 inherited our unproduced scripts and filmed a few of them, most notably Alan Brennett's fine adaptation of the Cold Equations, but otherwise had no connection to its predecessor, or to me. The Twilight Zone was a unique show, the perfect series for someone like me. My first thought, when it went off the air, was that I was done with Hollywood. Hollywood was not done with me, however. The corpse of TZ2 had scarcely cooled before I found myself writing a treatment for Max Headroom. A few months after that, one of my TZ scripts got into the hands of Ron Coslow, the creator and executive producer of a new urban fantasy series called Beauty and the Beast that would be making its premiere in the fall of 1987. I was not convinced that I wanted to do another show, but when my agent sent me a tape of Coslow's Beauty and the Beast pilot, the quality of the writing, acting, and cinematography blew me away. I joined the staff of Beauty and the Beast in June of 1987 and spent 3 years with the series, rising from executive story consultant to supervising producer. It was a very different sort of show than Twilight Zone had been, but once again I found myself working with some terrific actors, writers, and directors. The show was twice nominated for an Emmy Award as Best Dramatic Series. I wrote and produced 13 episodes, did uncredited rewrites on a score of others, and had a finger in everything from casting and budgeting to post-production, learning a great deal in the process. By the time Beauty and the Beast died its premature death, I had the experience and the credits to dream about creating and running a show of my own. Fast forward to the summer of 1991. I was back at home in Santa Fe. Though I worked in Hollywood for 10 years, I never actually moved to Los Angeles and would flee back to New Mexico and Paris the moment my current project wrapped. Since the end of Beauty and the Beast, I had written a pilot for a medical show and a screenplay for a low-budget science fiction movie. It wasn't so low-budget after I got done with it. Neither had gone anywhere, and no new assignment was in the offing, so I started work on a new novel. Avalon was science fiction, a return to my old future history. The writing seemed to be going well, until one day a chapter came to me about a young boy who goes to see a man beheaded. It was not part of Avalon, I knew, but I knew I had to write it, too. So I put the other book aside and began what would ultimately become a Game of Thrones. When I was 100 pages into the fantasy, however, my lovely and energetic Hollywood agent, Jody Levine, called to report that she'd gotten me pitch meetings at NBC, ABC, and Fox. CBS, the network that had aired both The Twilight Zone and Beauty and the Beast, was the only network that did not want to hear my ideas. Go figure. I had been telling Jody that my werewolf novella, The Skin Trade, would make a swell franchise for a series, and asking her to get me in to pitch it. Now she had. So I put a Game of Thrones in the same drawer with Avalon and flew out to L.A. to try and sell the networks on a buddy series about a hot young female private eye and an asthmatic hypochondriac werewolf. It's always best to have more than one string to your bow when fiddling for networks, so I noodled with some other notions on the plane. Somewhere over Phoenix, the opening line of the Lonely Songs of Larrendor came back to me. There is a girl who goes between the worlds. By the time I got off the plane, that line had mutated into a concept for an alternate world series I called Doors. It was later changed to Doorways to avoid confusion with Jim Morrison's band and Oliver Stone's film. It was Doors that ABC, NBC, and Fox all responded to, not The Skin Trade. I flew home thinking that Fox was the most likely of the three to bite, but ABC was faster on the trigger. A few days later, I had a pilot. Doorways became my life for the next 2 years. I took the project to Columbia Pictures Television, where my old Twilight Zone colleague Jim Crocker joined me as executive producer. The rest of 1991 I spent writing and rewriting the pilot. I did several story treatments and beat outlines before going to script. The toughest question I faced was deciding what sort of alternate world Tom and Kat should visit in the pilot. After long consultations with Jim Crocker and the execs at Columbia and ABC, I went with Winter World, a stark post-Holocaust Earth locked in the throes of a nuclear winter. My first draft, as usual, was too long and too expensive, but Crocker seemed pleased with it, as was Columbia. ABC was pleased as well with the first half of the script. Unfortunately, the network guys had changed their minds about what should happen when Tom and Kat go through the first door. Winterworld was too grim, they now decided. If we want the series, we could go there for an episode, certainly. But for the pilot, ABC felt we needed a less depressing scenario. It meant tearing up the entire second half of my script and doing it all over. But I gnashed my teeth, put in some late nights and long weekends, and got it done. In place of Winterworld, I sent Tom and Kat to a timeline where all the petroleum on Earth had been eaten some years earlier by a bioengineered virus designed to clean up oil spills. Needless to say, this caused a rather major burp. But civilization recovered after a fashion, and the resulting world was far less grim than Winterworld had been. In January 1992, ABC gave us a production order for a 90-minute pilot. To offset some of the projected budget deficits, my script was too long and too expensive, Columbia also decided to produce a 2-hour version for European television. Academy Award winner Peter Werner was hired to direct, and pre-production began. Casting was a hell and a half, and actually caused us to delay the shoot, with fateful consequences further down the road. But we finally found our regulars. George Newbern was perfect as Tom, Rob Nepper made a splendid Thane, and Kurtwood Smith was so good in his dual role as Traeger that we would have brought him back many times had we gone to series. For Kat, we had to go across the ocean to Paris, where we discovered a brilliant and beautiful young Breton stage actress named Anne Le Gurnick. I remain convinced that if Doorways had gone to series, Anne would have become a huge star. There was no one like her on American television, then or now. We found some great people for our guest roles, too, adding Hoyt Axton as Jake and Tisha Putman as Sissy. Finally, we were good to roll. When we screened a rough cut for ABC that summer, we got an enthusiastic reception and an order for 6 backup scripts, so we would be ready to go into production as a mid-season replacement in 1993. I wrote one of the 6 scripts myself, hired some terrific writers to do the other 5, and spent the remainder of 1992 and the first few months of 1993 doing rewrites, going over pattern budgets, and getting ready to go to series. It never happened. ABC passed. The why of that remains a matter of conjecture, though I have my theories. Bad timing might have been part of it. By the time we finally found our Tom and Kat, we had missed a development window for the 92 fall season. We seemed to be a lock for the fall of 93, but there was a shakeup at ABC before the decision day rolled around, and both of the execs who had supervised the pilot ended up leaving the network. We might also have made a mistake when we agreed to scrap Winterworld, which would have given the second half of the show a visual and visceral impact that no oil world could not match. The test audiences and focus groups would have gotten a much different idea of the dramatic potential of the series from a world in more desperate straits. Or maybe it was something else entirely. No one will ever know for certain. After ABC pulled the plug, Columbia screened the pilot for NBC, CBS, and Fox, but it's a rare thing for one network to pick up a project developed for another. Heinlein said it best, if you let them piss in the soup, they like the flavor better. Doorways died. I mourned a while and went on. You don't forget, though. 14 years have passed, but it still makes me sad to think what might have been. No writer wants to see his children buried in an unmarked grave. Doorways will always be the great what-if of my career. I wrote other pilots, Black Cluster, The Survivors, Starport, but Doorways was the only one to get beyond the script stage, the only one to be filmed, the only one to come within a whisker of winning a spot on a network's primetime schedule. If it had, who knows? It might have run for 2 episodes or for 10 years. I might still be writing and producing the show today, or I might have been fired 2 months into the series. The only certainty is that I would be much, much richer than I am at present. On the other hand, I would never have finished A Game of Thrones or written the other volumes of A Song of Ice and Fire. So maybe it all turned out for the best after all.